Good afternoon and welcome, everybody. It's lovely to see you, at least as attendees. I don't see your faces. Welcome to our first ever virtual Israel Studies seminar and the first seminar of this new and different Michaelmas term. The nature of Teams live events is such that we cannot see the faces of all the attendees or participants. And I have to apologize for this, but this is part of the package of allowing everybody to just join. On the other hand, we do have the option to have a conversation through the Q&A. So if you look probably to the right of your screen, there's an option to post questions. And after each presentation, you will be able to write your questions and I will be moderating this in a way. And I guess I have to ask you to bear with us as we are learning together how to utilize this tool. It is with immense pleasure and sadness that I don't that I'm not able to do it in person, really face to face or at least face to mask. Real genuine ultimate pleasure to present to you the speaker, Professor Sandy Kedar. Professor Kedar teaches law at the Haifa University's Law School. His research focuses on legal geography, legal history, law and society, and land regimes in settler societies, and in Israel. He served as the president of the Israeli Law and Society Association. He is the coordinator of the legal geography, CRN, of the Law and Society Association. And he is a member of the international committee of this association. He is the co-founder in 2003 and director of the Association for Distributive Justice, an Israeli NGO addressing these issues. I must also note, maybe on a more personal note, that the first time I met Sandy was some 20 years ago or so, when a small group of people organized as the Mizrahi Democratic Rainbow was celebrating a legal victory of what is usually known today as the Bagatz HaKarkaot, a landmark decision by the Israeli court regarding the distribution of state-held lands. Sandy was a main person, or the main person, to oversee the litigation on the Rainbow's side, and he is credited, duly credited, among many other things, also with this landmark decision or victory. The title of Professor Kedar's talk today is that of his recently published book, Emptied Lands, Legal Geography of the Bedouin Rights in the Negev. And now I should bring to life Sandy. Thank you.
Am I live now?
You are.
I see you. Ah, no, I don't know. Well, hi. So everybody sees me now because I see you. It's okay, but I guess... Yeah. Okay, so hello everyone. I must say that I would have preferred to be with you in Oxford instead of sitting in my room in my home, but I think it's part of our age and time. I hope that it won't last too long. So really I wanted to thank Oxford University and the Center for Global and Area Studies, and particularly Yaakov, that I know, as he said, for many, many years. And what I would like to do is to talk for about 40 minutes, something like that, to present some issues that we touched upon in my co-authored book, Empty Lands, which I published with a legal scholar, Ahmad Amara, and political geographer Oren Iftachel. So now I will try to share my presentation with you. I hope it works. Can you see it, Yaakov? I can't hear you now, wait.
Yes, we are seeing you and the presentation alongside it.
Okay. So what I would like to do in the lecture is first to say a few things about my involvement in the issue of the Bedouin land rights, then move to give a bit of very short background at the situation of the Bedouins in the Negev, then give a short overview of the book, then in the land dispute between Israel and the Bedouins of the Negev, and focus on what we term the dead Negev doctrine, or in short, DND, which we argue is a major legal and geographical doctrine that enables Israel to claim or to argue that Bedouins are trespassers on their historical land, if you want. And I will also offer some critique of the dead Negev Bedouins. So when we talk about Bedouins and unrecognized Bedouin settlements, I should say that there are about a quarter of a million Bedouins in the area of the Negev. After that, I will show you also some maps. And the Bedouins historically have been organized as many tribes or indigenous people in the region of in our regions into what we call confederations, which are groupings of different tribes, and then they are in their turn divided into tribes and sub-tribes and so on. So it's a very tribal or indigenous system of social organization. I can talk about it later, but it's not the subject of the book or the presentation. Half of the Bedouins that are living in the Negev, about half live in what is Israel is titling as unrecognized or illegal settlement. That's very important. So as some Bedouins are saying, the minute I'm born, I'm illegal, because though many of them are living there and their parents for generations, but even though they are considered as trespassing on what is defined as state land, and not only they don't receive any rights, but they are also don't receive even basic settlement, basic services, including, for example, shelters or schools where they live. They have to commute sometimes very far away to go to school. In many cases, they don't have medical services in their space. If Israel, they don't have electricity, they don't have running water, because the state considered it as state land and says that it will not allow these people to receive these services. They say, since it's not your land and you built without permit, you are trespassing on this land. And there is also, I mean, there are waves, but there is quite an intensive process of state destruction of dwellings. By and large, we can say that on average, there are many more house dwelling. I want to say dwelling or houses, but it's sometimes also shops and stuff like that. They are destructed by the state, by Israel, and there are many more destructions in of Bedouin dwellings than in the occupied territories. Just to give you of Palestinian house, I'm talking about Palestinian houses, not talking about outposts, the Jewish outposts. I'm talking about Palestinian Palestinian dwellings, and all this is based on a formalist system of settlement of title that is based on a British imported and legislated system, which is called the Torrens system of land settlement, which is kind of geographical legal system that defines who owns certain area. And it's a very formal quasi-judicial system in which Israel is arguing that practically all the Negev is state land. Now, just to give you an idea, so this is, if you want, the photos that an unrecognized village near Be'er Sheva. It's very standard if you want to general processes of what some scholars call the illegal cities or shanty towns that spread around major cities, particularly in the south. And because the land is not recognized, Israel is in the process of house demolition over and over. For example, the village of Al-Araqib, which is an unrecognized village, has been destroyed over and over and over by the state, and the Bedouins are clinging to their dwellings and so on. Now, just to say to present my involvement, so I am, first of all, an academic scholar, but I am in a position, or my view is that academic scholars can be also intellectual engagé persons. So I believe that sometimes you should use your knowledge in order to struggle over social issues. We can talk about it a bit in the QAA about the connection between academic work and academic truth and being involved in a specific struggle. It's not easy, but I think I'd be happy to open this issue because I think it's interesting. But so I would say that I'm involved. I was involved in a case that reached the Israeli Supreme Court, the El-Ukbi case, which we cover also in the book. And I'm somehow also involved in another case now of in El-Araqib, where Bedouin Sheikh is in and out of jail for trespassing over the land of what he claims to be our his tribal land and so on. So this is as a beginning. So I move to the book. So this is the book, and the picture of the book is actually a demolition of a dwelling in Araqib and some nice doves over it. And what I would like to do in the next part is to present shortly the book. How it is structured, and I would like to focus on the fact that it is a very interdisciplinary book. I see myself, or I work within, I would say, several fields. Generally, I studied history and law, and I studied legal history. I did my doctoral dissertation with Professor Morton Horowitz, who is a very famous legal historian at Harvard. And I slowly became involved in the general field of law and society, and also more and more in legal geography. My co-author Ahmad Amara, who is also a lawyer, did his PhD on Ottoman legal history. He also studied Ottoman Turkish, so he can read the documents, and part of his work was to go to the archives in Istanbul and Ankara and study the issue. And our third author is Oren Iftachel, who is a political geographer but also a planner. So I think that what we can say is that the book also reflects the relatively wide range of the three authors. It's not very easy because we write differently, we come from different disciplines, so we had many, many versions of the book, But I think that it's worthwhile if you try to tackle with a very complex issue. I think it's very difficult to be able to master it from only one disciplinary perspective, because what we're talking about is very intertwined itself. So the book goes like that. We begin with the setting of the book. We give a general overview of several stories of the land dispute between the Bedouins and the state, several examples. For example, we talk about the fact that during operation, one of the last operation in Gaza, one of the only Israeli victims was a Bedouin in an unrecognized village that was hit by the Hamas. And we discovered, I mean, it was discovered that Iron Dome does not work in unrecognized villages because it's not on the maps. So they're not protecting it. At least that was the official story or presentation of the Israeli state to the Supreme Court when it dealt with it. So being unrecognized is extremely, I mean, we introduce the reader to the life and death issue of being unrecognized. And for example, when Israeli authority are planning Route 6, which is the major north-south route, they just plan it on unrecognized villages because they are not on the map, so they don't take account of it. They just drive through it. So we talk about several issues and give examples, and mainly the book is also structured. Again, we have our main character, who is Nuri Elukbi, who is a Bedouin, now is in his mid-70s, who's been actually educated in a kibbutz, and but he's part of the El-Ukbi tribe, and he's struggling over the land rights, and the book weaves his attempt to overcome or try to gain what he really believes in the Israeli system, or try in the legal system, and tries to get his rights, and we go with him from the lower courts up to the Supreme Court, but we give also a general overview. So this is the introduction. Then we give a few scholarly and legal frameworks. We explain a bit what are the Bedouin Arabs, and also, you know, what I was talking about, confederation, tribes. It's quite complicated, and in many cases with indigenous people, we use legal geography, and we work within the framework of settler colonial and indigenous dispossession. We also use the term of ethnocracy that Oren Iftachel has coined. So this is generally this kind of setting, the scholarly and legal frameworks. Then we move to a critical and legal history of what we call the Dead Negev Doctrine. And what we do here is we divided it into three major periods. One is the late Ottoman period. So we try to explain what were the laws enforced during the Ottoman period. And it's not always very easy to discover and what law was enforced and what not, but it's very important to understand the role of the legal setting of the Ottoman period, because as I will show later, the Israeli state, one of the important claims of the Israeli state is that it is not dispossessing the Bedouins and it is not changing the law, because what it is doing is implementing the law that was in force before the establishment of Israel, and specifically and even more during the late Ottoman period. So we'll say, claim, what do you want from us? We are just protecting what was defined as state land under the Ottomans, who are even Muslims. So it's not that the Zionist state is doing anything to dispossess Bedouin, but on the contrary. So the first, chapter two shows that the Israeli interpretation of the Ottoman legislation is very problematic. So, and I want to stress that as a legal scholar, I am not a formalist legal scholar. I think that in most cases, law does not speak for itself. You have to go through interpretation and you have to understand the context. So you cannot just look at the words and decide that this is it. So one of the arguments is that Israel in every junction is opting for the most detrimental interpretation of the laws to the Bedouins, okay? So it's not that you can, first of all, some of the laws, it's not even, you know, clear if they were in force or not, whether they're published, whether they're, anyhow, what is important is that the major legislation, which is the Ottoman Land Code from 1858, remains the major bone of contention of actually both the Bedouins and the Palestinian, or a major bone of contention between Bedouins and also Palestinian in occupied territory, more than 150 years after it was enacted, and more than, I don't know, decades after it was annulled in Turkey or in Ottoman. So it has it does not exist in Turkey, but it still is a major law in force here in the area, in Israel and in Palestine, if you want. And so it's very important to understand it. So we did a lot of work on that. Then we moved to the British Mandate period, which also preceded Israel, and we analyze the changes introduced by the British, among others, as I said before, the settlement of title system, and also, Yaakov, if you talk, I don't hear you. I see you moving, but I don't know, I don't hear you. I
no,
don't
no,
hear
I
you.
No point, no, no, I'm listening very attentively.
You know, okay, and so there are some issues like changes that the British introduced. They make some amendments to the Ottoman relevant legislation on something called the Mawat. It's a kind of land type that Israel relies on. So we analyze that and we go over the cases from the British Mandate period and analyze them and show what was going on in the law by the courts that ruled in Palestine during the British Mandate. And then the last part of this chapter, we review and analyze the construction, what we call the Dead Negev Doctrine, that I will explain. But essentially, our understanding is that it is very similar to the doctrine of terra nullius that was, for example, used in Australia, or empty land, this doctrine that the land is empty and therefore nobody had rights on the land. So this is based on analysis of committees and governmental committees and legal cases and so on, that we show the construction of this doctrine, and we continue until today, or until a few years ago. Then, after we established this pillar, which is the pillar, I would say, of the legal history, we move to the legal geography of the Negev. And here we have two major chapters. One, look at the question of the historical geography of the Negev. One of the arguments, which is also very common for settler colonial discourse, and also for, I don't know how many of you are knowledgeable of legal doctrine, but for example, the view of John Locke of who has a right to the land, the person who ties labor, the theory of labor of John Locke, which is very prominent in issues of property. So the idea is that Bedouins were nomads, they did not cultivate the land, they had no no connection to the land, so they didn't have any right. If even if they were there, they were just passing through, just like, you know, Aborigines in Australia or Native Americans in North Africa and so on. So we analyze it and actually show, based on a lot of documents, that Bedouins had quite a lot of agriculture. For example, they were a major exporters of barley to beer industry in Europe, in England, and in actually and in other places, you know. So we show that the construction of the Bedouins as not tiling the land is just incorrect. It's all, of course, debated, and the debate continues. But and then the next chapter six, goes and looks at the question of their concept of territory and settlements, because according to Israeli understanding, Bedouins were nomads, so not only they did not cultivate the land, but they don't have any attachment, and they were, and the symbol is the tent. And we show that Bedouins had in the period, at least since the 19th century, but even before, had a pattern that is called semi-nomadism, which is very different, and they were moving, but from regular or permanent places. So they had a winter and summer place, but sometimes they returned to the same poles of their tents, and everybody knew very well who owns what and where. So we show that the idea of the Bedouins roaming all over, I don't know, all over the Middle East is just incorrect historically, and it also has a an importance. Then the next chapter or part looks at international comparative and Israeli perspective, and we look at the question whether Bedouins are indigenous or not. And this is important because, well, first of all, it's very important because when we talk about indigenous Israels, Israelis are immediately terrified that if the Bedouins are indigenous, what does it mean that we, the Israeli Jews, are? I at least think that more than one group can be indigenous to the land, because people can construct, because I think that all these things are constructed identity as anyhow. I think that it's not an objective thing. So anyhow, we can talk about it. We also did not agree among the authors about all the details, but it's also very important legally, because if we are correct, as we show in chapter seven, that the Bedouin fit the structure of being indigenous, and when you compare it to other groups, not only in European settler colonial places, but also in Africa and Asia. Okay, indigenous group in Asia and Africa. And we lack, there is no agreed upon definition of indigenous people, but there are characteristics. And we argue that based on the characteristic that we suggest, Bedouins are not less indigenous than other groups that are perceived as indigenous by other indigenous groups. And if we are correct in what we say in chapter seven, and I think we are, then I just say that not only Israelis are unhappy with the definition of Bedouins as indigenous, but also many Palestinian Arabs and Palestinian Israeli Arabs say we are all indigenous, and other Palestinians. So there, it's a very interesting debate. We can talk about it, but at least my position is that the Bedouins are indigenous according to the definition, the international law characterization. I mean, there is a difference between anthropology, sociology, and so on. I think that when you look at the legal discourse, the international law discourse, then they fit their characterization. And that is important because in chapter 8, we argue that the Bedouin, the international law currently, since the UN Declaration of Indigenous People of 2007, what we could, I think 2007, forgot, at least this declaration became what we call among legal scholars customary international law, part of it. And customary international law is a norms that states must comply to. I mean, it's compelling the states in the countries unless they legislate directly against it. And there is no Israeli legislation against it. And according to the Israeli system, the internal legal system, Israel is obliged to follow customary international law. It doesn't do it. I mean, it's different in the occupied territories, but in Israel proper, Israel formally is obliged and compelled to abide by it. And therefore, if we are right, Israel, including the Israeli Supreme Court, are not following international law. So it has at least, the argument is very important in that sense. Anyhow, the next and last part is contested futures, in which we look at state solutions, processes and proposal, how to solve the issue not through a legal system, but kind of other alternative ways. And also what we call a seeking planning solution. Oren Iftachel, my co-author, was heading a long-term project of trying to use Israeli planning principles on Bedouin unrecognized settlements. They went and made a lot of workshops with Bedouins, and they reached the conclusion that about in 99% of the cases, or 90%, more than 90% of the cases, if you apply the Israeli planning system on the Bedouins, including things similar to kibbutzim, to moshavim, to individual ranches and so on, and you allocate the land not on the base of ethnicity but on the base of citizenship, practically all Bedouins could be settlements, what we call unrecognized settlements, could be recognized where they are. And we conclude in the conclusion, the conclusion is based on two parts. The first part is a review of the Israeli Supreme Court case in the El Ukbi case, which was delivered right when we were writing the book, and rejected all the arguments that we told you here. Essentially, there's a currently the decision was written by the current president of the Supreme Court, Chayut, but she wasn't the president, but essentially she rejected all this argument, and we analyzed her decision also and criticize it, and then conclude. I mean, there is a part about future and so on. So this is, if you want, the structure of the book. And what is, how long do you give me? 10, 15? I don't hear you.
I think about 10 more minutes would be...
Yeah. Okay, so what I do now is I'll just give you, we are talking, can you see also my cursor or just?
Yes, we can see your cursor too.
Okay, so the area of the unrecognized villages is about here today mostly. I mean, this is the Negev. before that, the Bedouins were mostly in the northern part of the Negev, but there were also Bedouins in the south. This is, if you want, it's part of the appendixes of our book and the maps. So this is where most, every point here is a location of the Bedouins. This is the land claims, again, most of the land claims that the Bedouins has filed. This is just a photo of destructions going on in the Negev. And what I want to do in the next few minutes is just to give you an overview of the dead Negev doctrine, and then a bit of criticism, and you stop me. I probably will not have time to say everything, so you stop me whenever you feel like. So when we talk about the dead Negev doctrine, what I say is that Israel created a legal doctrine that facilitates settlement and land nationalization, which is called the dead Negev doctrine, and its logic resembles that of the Terra Nullius, but we have seen a lot of distortions in the dead Negev doctrine, and essentially in each legal, historical, geographical, and discretion point, there is a choice made, and this is important. I said I'm not a formalist. There is a choice to the detriment of the Bedouins. So, and all that is incremental. So, in the end, in each point they lose, in the end they lose almost all cases. What I want to stress is that often indigenous dispossession entails also denial. We all like to think about ourselves as good people, or most of us, and the dead Negev doctrine is a spatial legal justificatory doctrine, which is very good because it dispossesses while simultaneously denying the dispossession, because say we're not taking anything from you because it's belonging to the state. And it's based on intertwined, often ambiguous, historical, legal, and geographical claims and procedural and evidentiary legal tools, which we contest throughout the book. One of key moves was the classification of the entire Negev region as dead or Mawat land, which this term derives from Muslim tradition and later appears in the Ottoman land code and also in British mandate legislation. We devote a lot of time to it, but because of time limits, I will not get into it now. The dead Negev doctrine is constantly wavering between norms and facts, substance and procedure, law, history, and geography. And its inherent stealthiness is an important channel by which its hegemonic power is fought. And what is important is that it all the time the choice is presented as constraint, but we distilled and refuted 8 core D&D components. And now I'll try to run on them, the 8, and end in that. So. The first one is that Israel claims legal continuity with and scrupulous application of Ottoman and British land laws, particularly the settlement of title legislation and those regulating Mawat and Miri land. But we show lack of continuity with Ottoman and British mandate law and practices. This is the first part of the book. Then Israel claims lack of organized functioning and property land system within the Bedouins, but we show that there was an existence and persistence of an elaborate, consistent, and well-functioning indigenous tribal land system. And I continue. The previous regime never recognized, so goes Israel, Bedouin legal autonomy or customary law. But what we show is that there was a lack of effective Ottoman rule in the region until at the very least 1901, when Be'er Sheva was established. and there was legal and autonomy granted to the Bedouin by the Ottomans and by the British Mandate rulers. We also show that there was an extensive sale of Bedouin land to Jewish and Arab purchasers during late Ottoman and particular British times. And its successful title registration, which confirmed the Bedouins' traditional land system and the position of previous government that they did not own the land. Israel argues that the Bedouin also failed to register their land until a specific date. I will not get into it now, but I'll give you some examples of recognition by previous regimes. So, for example, the Ottoman bought the land for building Beersheba from the Bedouins. So if they thought it did not belong to the Bedouin, they would not have bought it. Churchill, the Secretary of State at the period, wrote that he reaffirms the assurances already given in Beersheba by the High Commissioner to the Sheikh that the special rights and custom of the Bedouin tribes of Beersheba will not be interfered with. And a letter to Ben-Gurion, the British mandate, wrote that they regard the land as belonging to Bedouin tribes. I will not get into it because of lack of time. There was regular acquisition of land from Bedouin by Jews, and it was registered by the Ottoman and British authorities. Actually, my great uncle, Moshe Smilansky, was buying land from the Bedouins, the author Moshe Smilansky. And it's a high quantity. I'm running because I'm running out of time. So, and we can see, for example, a map. Actually, all the Jewish settlements that were established before 1948 were built on Bedouin, on land bought from the Bedouins. I continue. The arguments go that until at least 1921, Bedouins did not cultivate regularly the Negev land, but we show that there was a pervasive cultivation. And also the argument that they were nomadic, lacking permanent settlements, but we show that they were semi-nomadic and not nomadic. For example, we have a map which is based on aerial photos made by the British of all the tents in the Negev, and we analyze it and we show that it's based on a settlement pattern that is very logical and not just spread out, as I said. So we show it. And then we can show, for example, reports. This is by the Palestine Land Development Company, a very important Jewish company, reports on land cultivation and ownership of land as they perceived it by, in this case, it's Arab Akabane, which is the name for the El Ukbi tribe. I continue, I have two more and then I finish. The Bedouins, the argument goes, are not indigenous group, but we show that they fit the characterization of indigenous people in international law. Israel argues that the legal burden to establish the right against all these stipulations, that is 1 to 7, all the legal onus, the legal burden is on the Bedouin, which is almost impossible, because you look at the case and Israel come a Bedouin tribe or a person claimant and ask for recognition, and Israel said you have to show that you cultivated this specific dunum of land, this specific tract of land, before 1858 sometimes. And how can you do it? There is no aerial photos. When they bring some description by people that were moving in the area. For example, people that were searching for the Bible traces, you know, all these kind of people that were running around, or even spies and so on. The court said it's not accurate enough. I mean, somebody is describing that he walked 3 hours southwest of I don't know what, but how do we know it's your truck? And when they describe that they encounter something, it's not good enough. So in a way, it's very clear that this is in a way a game. I mean, the game is very important in legitimation. Say you can try to prove your, you fail to prove. That means you are a trespasser on state land, and we protect the state land. On the other end, in international, regional, and national norms, they increasingly grant land and territorial rights to indigenous community, but also adapt procedural and evidence rules to be more congruous with indigenous norms and practices. For example, the Canadian Supreme Court recently said, well, you cannot demand an indigenous group to act as if he was 200 years ago acting according to our system of laws, with a lawyer counseling them how to register their land. It's just impossible. But Israel continues. So I will stop here, and I will probably try to stop the share screen, or you can do it. I don't know.
Thank you, Sandy. I think I have the control over this. This is fascinating.
So much. I'm back.
You're on the back now. I think people see me for a second before you're back for questions and answers. I need to make just one clarification. To ask questions, I see that people are doing this already. You can post your question, and I have somehow the censorship role of choosing which to publish and which not to publish. Obviously, I will publish all that are not crazy, I guess. And I think the best would be for us, Sandy, for me to read the questions just for the record. This is people asking, not necessarily my own questions. And you, let's take them one by one so you can choose which to answer. So let me just put you on. I'm publishing the questions right now. Yeah. So the first question, I think all can see, if you open the questions and answer tab, you can see the question yourself.
I don't see anything.
I just read it aloud then. So the question is from
Anonymous. I saw it before and it disappeared. I don't know why.
It's under published now. If you go to published, you can see them. So this is from an anonymous attendee who writes, Palestinians are indigenous, whether they are Bedouin or not. Modern international law is a colonial legal system that structurally discriminates against non-state groups, and like any legal system, its application is a matter of power. So Israel refers to or relies on international law when it serves its interests. On the other hand, Israel relies on international law to claim that its colonial state is legitimate. On the other hand, Israel consistently claims that international laws should not apply to its acts because of one or another excuse. So the question is, do you believe that international law can influence the Israeli court decisions?
Okay, so it's an excellent question. I don't know why I don't see the previous question, but I've seen it before and then it disappeared. But anyhow, I don't know if you... it will be easier because I mean, now I have a sign saying no new questions. Anyhow.
Do you see the published questions, though? If you have a published
what? Tab.
On the Q&A, there's a published...
I don't know. I don't see it, but I will answer anyhow. So the questions is based on several sub-questions. The first one is the question whether Palestinians are an indigenous people. I mean, this is not a question, it's a statement, but it's a statement that we discussed among the authors, and actually now I'm writing an article with a PhD student of mine, and she's a Palestinian, Israeli-Palestinian, or Palestinian citizens of Israel, and we agreed not to agree. So we, my view is the following. There is a difference. Indigenous is actually, of course, a Western creation. It's a Western term. Nobody was born indigenous. People were born, I don't know, Maori and Cherokee and so on. So nobody was born as indigenous. Indigenous is a creation, a Western creation. It comes from French, indigène, and it was used in a derogatory way. And then after that, in a very interesting way, indigenous people use this term as to empower them. So there is in our chapter about indigenous people, there is an analysis of the term. And what I want to stress is the following. In different disciplines, there are different definitions. Now, I think that, and by the way, neither Oren nor Ahmed do agree with me. Okay, so we didn't put it in the book. We have a discussion. I think that Bedouins fit the characteristic of indigenous people in a different way that, let's say, somebody in Ramallah fits this definition. Now, my understanding is the following. Bedouins are indigenous. They are also Arab citizens of Israel. They are also Palestinians. There are many other things, like I am also many other things. On the other hand, in the international law definition, I don't think the Palestinians fit the narrow characterization of indigenous people, but they fit a much more powerful definition, which is they are a people, they are a nation, they have a right to their own state. So it's more powerful. I mean, to be indigenous is weaker than to be a nation or a state or a people. And for example, indigenous don't have a right to the people that don't have the right to their own countries, their own state. So, and I think that Palestinians are indigenous to the land, but they are not indigenous people according to the narrow definition of what is indigenous in international. So this is my answer to the first part of the question. The second is we chose, as scholars that work with the Bedouins, and also some of the Bedouins chose this definition, because in the specific context of Israel, it can help their land claims. It can assist their land claims. It's not, in other contexts, it can be detrimental, but in this context, we think that they can have some kind of benefits from being defined as indigenous, particularly in the sense that it moves the debate away only from internal Israeli courts to a more international arena. Now, unfortunately, unlike, for example, what happens in Africa and in the Americas, where there are regional international courts, Israel is not subject to such courts. But in the general discussion, there is a benefit to that. So I don't think, and of course, Israel is not abiding by international law in many other places, and many other countries are not abiding by international law. But as a discourse, I think that it has benefits, especially when you don't have clear-cut property rights. I hope I answered this question.
Thank you. I will read the next question. This is from Mehdi Askariye. Who says, thank you for a very interesting talk, Alexander. What is the status of Bedouins' land claim against the State of Israel now?
It's So the status is the following. The last important case was the Elukbi case, which was ruled about 4 or 5 years ago. It reached the Supreme Court, as I said, and then it was even reached a further hearing, which is another status, and the further hearing by the president and president of the Israeli Supreme Court was denied. So many of the arguments that were made by the Elukbi were dismissed by the Israeli Supreme Court. However, I'm now somehow involved in another case. I mean, we can talk about it. The problem with the Elukbi case was it began by lawyers that were not really extremely, I don't know how to say it. I will stop here. And in the middle of the case, we got involved and convinced, I was not involved in the case from the beginning. We got involved, Oren Iftachel as an expert opinion, and I was there in a sabbatical and I returned to Israel and got involved. And we convinced Nuri Elukbi to, that he might, it might be a good idea to change his lawyers. And then he changed it into one of the best lawyer in Israel on these issues, Michael Sfard, who also worked a lot in the occupied territories. But it was too late for introducing some of the evidence. I mean, there were a lot of mistakes made in the procedure. So, and now the other case is started from the beginning with Michael Sfard. So we think that we might, I'm not sure, I mean, it's very problematic, we might make some gains. But in general, I would say that the land claims, they lost 100% of their land claims so far in Israeli courts. So not great.
Yeah, a couple of technical questions and maybe suggestions. So first of all, the attendee who appeared as anonymous to ask the questions is noting that they were not meant to be anonymous, but they are sent anonymously. This is how live Teams event works. So I can just suggest if you want your name to be mentioned, I think it would be great to see who's asking what, specifically that we are, you know, we're 20 people or now 16, but it's a large enough group to know each other, small enough group to know each other. You can just write your name before the question and we'll know who's asking and I'll present you. You can, of course, remain anonymous. Another question is asking if you can move, if we can change to Zoom, not this term. There are so many different elements playing here. I know this is a pain also, I can tell you for myself, but it moves between the financial and the legal that the university is asking us to do this, or I'm sorry, ordering us to do it this way. And I think I'm picking my fights selectively right now. Moving on to the third question, which was also actually on my list of issues to bring to discussion. It has to do with the Bedouins' involvement in the Israeli army. The question, again, from Anonymous, who probably didn't mean to be anonymous, how do you explain the very powerful involvement of Bedouin in the IDF in view of the terrible treatment of them, the Bedouin, in the Israeli, by the Israeli public and the legal system that you've so clearly outlined?
So it's also a very good question. And I would say that the involvement is not very strong. I mean, not every the Bedouins that are serving in the Israeli army are a minority of the Bedouins. Now you have to understand a bit the history of the Bedouins. I will say a few words about the history of what happened before and after 1948. So there is a debate about how many Bedouins were there before 1948 in the Negev. We estimate that something between 80 to 100,000 Bedouins. Israel thinks a little less, but it's not very important for your question. What is important is to know that most Bedouins during the war moved away from the fighting forces during the war in the Negev. And the borders were not very clear. And then some of them moved, let's say, to Sinai or to Jordan and so on. And then after 1948, there was a committee established during, actually immediately during the war, after the war, to decide who could return or remain in Israel of the Bedouins. And the committee that was headed, I think, by Yigal Alon, who was the commander of the Southern Front, and some very high-ranking officers, not only in army, but officials and so on, decided that what they called the friendly Bedouins will be allowed to remain. Friendly Bedouins were Bedouins, for example, that sold land to Jews before 1948, Bedouins that were helping the IDF during, or the Haganah during the war, for example, as spies and stuff like that. And also Bedouins that were neutrals in some sense. So out of this, many, many Bedouins that existed, lived in the area before 1948, they remain, I mean, it changed until the late 50s, but there remained about 12 to 15,000 Bedouins in the Negev. And they were the friendly Bedouins. And many of them received weapons from the Israeli army and were helping the Israeli army to keep the borders against the other Bedouins, because Israel also used internal strifes and so on and paid them and so on. So they began, and I would also say that the Bedouins were not, a lot of them were very different. Their identity was not Palestinian. A lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them have their internal Bedouin identity, their tribal identity. Many of them, not all of them, but some of them at least, were not connected to, let's say, the Palestinian strife, or at least those that remained. And so Israel allowed them to volunteer. It was not a draft, but allowed them to volunteer to the IDF, to the Israeli Defense Forces. And it's also, you have to understand that their occupation, their work, I mean, possibilities are not very big, were not very big. So one of the things they could do is go and serve in the police, in the army, and so on. But in the last years, there is also a strong change within the Bedouin population, and the Islamic movement is getting stronger. And also, there is also a decrease in their military service, and I will end in the following. Still, there are a lot of people that are serving, officers. For example, I was teaching a course in law and society to a master for Israeli judges, and I took them to the unrecognized villages. And then came a Bedouin who said, look, on my left hand, this is my Miluin, I just came back from serving in reserve duty. And on the right side, it's the demolition order. And you know, so this is also happening. I hear an echo, Yaakov.
This is my fault. I'm sorry. I opened my microphone a bit too early.
Ah, okay. Hopefully so this is my answer.
Yeah. Sandy, there are several more very interesting questions. May I just ask you, I want to get to all of them. So if you just, you know, answer them in an unsatisfactory, quick manner.
Okay.
And these are questions from people who are probably within the organization, so we see their names. Joe Bergen asks, says, thank you for an excellent brief. Do the Bedouin of the Negev have a coherent political identity to make this case that you have very clearly explained today, formally for themselves, to the Israeli lawmakers? If not, How will the issue be addressed effectively?
Well, you know, again, so I'll be short. They don't have, I mean, they see, I mean, no, they don't have a coherent identity. I think nobody of us has a coherent identity. I don't believe in coherence in identities anyhow. And I think that the Bedouins are not different. For example, there is a fascinating movement of Bedouin feminist activists, which is amazing. For example, Bedouin women who are struggling against polygamy on one side and against the dispossession of Bedouin on the other side, and the marginalization of women, and trying to go over, for example, tribal strifes and honor killings and stuff like that. So, of course, you know, coherence, I don't believe in coherence anyhow, in full coherence. But there are some organizations of the Bedouins. For example, there is an organization which is called the Regional Council of Unrecognized Villages, which represent all the unrecognized villages and are pretty sophisticated. They use also help of professionals. For example, the work that Oren Iftachel did on planning was done with NGOs and with the regional council. So, and there are politicians and there are intellectuals. So, and they're going sending representative to the UN and so on. So, but of course, like many other things, there is also a policy of divide and rule by the Israeli state. There are, you know, things going on underneath. For example, people that receive land and it's not clear how, you know, the Israel tries to buy some cooperation from leaders and or give you access to water or to electricity or I don't know what. But it's also very, very typical to politics of indigenous groups and the relationship with state. So this is a short answer. I'll try shorter even. But now we are muted.
Thank you. A short question that is probably deserving much more attention than we can give it in, you know, in whatever time we left, is from Richard Kaplan. What is the Israeli public reaction to the Bedouin question?
Again, Israeli public is general, but you know, there are many different voices. It's interesting. I mean, the Bedouins are, I mean, Israel tries to concentrate the Bedouins in townships, but it's not very successful. They destroy houses they are building. You know, there are a lot of people there. So even part of the officials, the authorities, are understanding that there should be some kind of accommodation. There are, for example, some mayors of Jewish cities in the region that are working with the Bedouins because they understand that they have common interests also. There are some activists that work with the Bedouins, but by and large, there is a group, right-wing or groups are very much against it. For example, the NGO called the Regavim, which is also active in occupied territory, is very active against them. People like Smutrich in the right, in Yemina party, is really anti-Bedouins. Every even attempt of the state to make concession is seen as selling the land to the Bedouins and opening a corridor between Gaza and the West Bank, an Arab corridor moving from and threatening to the state. So it's very varied. But I would say most of the public is just doesn't care a lot. At least if you don't live in the Negev and you don't, I would say, you know, there are also a lot of problems going on. You know, there is some criminality going on among some of the Bedouins. You know, it's when you look, you were born as illegal. You know, some of them, again, it's complicated. So, and when you have now Corona, you know, there is, for example, there was a very high rate of Corona in Rahat, the largest recognized Bedouin village, town, city actually already. And of course, Bedouins are working in Be'er Sheva and working in the region. So you know, it's not that they live, you know, the distance is very small. It's not that we're not talking about Alaska, you know, period.
Alisa Simon's question actually relates to the first question. You touched upon it slightly, but maybe you can expand. The question is, what civil society organizations are involved in this issue? Maybe you can name them on behalf of the Bedouins. You also mentioned those who work against them. And the question continues, do you think there is another domain which would be more helpful and successful other than the court system to advance the Bedouin case?
Okay, so there are quite a few NGOs. As I said, the Regional Council of the Unrecognized Villages. There is something called Forum du Kiyum, who was Jewish Arab. There are some organization of younger Bedouins like Sidra and others. The Agudat Zechuyot HaEzrach, the Association for Civil Rights in Israel, is working with them. Sometimes Adala. There is a bunch of NGOs working with them, and a bunch of NGOs working against them. Also activists or that are not in NGOs, there are politicians and so on. So now about alternative, I think actually that the court system is not the right place for solving. I was in favor of mediation. But there was an attempt, but then, as happens often in Israel, is that when a new minister is nominated, they move to another system. So Shitrit was the minister responsible for the Bedouins about 15 years ago and checked the possibility of having a mediation, even brought a group that as it had experience of a negotiation between state and Native American tribes in the US, and they did a pilot, and it seemed to have some kind of potential, but then they moved to another policy. I think that my view is that what can be very successful is a combination of several means. First of all, is what they call, or the Palestinians call, the sumud, the clinging to the land. You know, it's very difficult. Each demolition of each house, you have to bring hundreds of policemen and other people, and it's costly, and it's problematic. And then you build that, and then let's say you demolish four or five houses. But you know, it's not very difficult to build them again. So they cling, you know, Israel also is somehow limited in its, you know, what it wants to do. It will not, I mean, if you want to win the Bedouins, really, you have to put them in a camp, you know, even that, it will not be very, very happy to close them there. So the sumud, I think, is very effective, the fact that they cling to the land. And also there is some effectiveness in international discourse. So my view, and also some kind of cooperation with Jewish municipalities and locals and so on. So Israel has been trying to oust the Bedouins from what it sees its own land for at least since the last 20 years. And it has not been very successful. So so that's
I guess it's a lesson in on political action. Maybe the last question from the Q&A, and I would maybe allow myself one closing question. The question is from Halil Abu Hussein, who is writing, thank you very much for the talk. Hadid is quoting you, the legal burden to establish their rights against these stipulations rests solely on the Bedouin, end of your quote. Can you elaborate on this more and how they can get past this obstacle that imposed on them? Is there any chance that they will prove their ownership in the Israeli court system? Secondly, activism versus academia, what you mentioned maybe earlier in the opening. This is a fascinating topic. How can you draw the line where to be involved in the cases as an activist and intellectual, engaged intellectual, and not interfere with your work as a scholar? Nowadays, we need those voices in academia in order to engage with the changes we are hoping for. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So I will, first question is about the burden of proof, I understand, and how you can overcome it, yeah? So Israel, I mean, I've written about it for many years already. This is a great system of legitimation because you don't say you don't have a right. But what you say is you make the procedures and the burden of proof very, very difficult. It's, again, we did not invent it. It happened in many settler colonial systems. You say you just have to prove, or you have a certain amount of day to file a complaint or to claim. And you know that because of internal dynamics, because of problem of bringing the proof and the evidence, you cannot do it in 30 days or a year even. So, and then the case is ended. You know, I've done some comparative work on what happened with Chicanos in the southern United States when it was conquered by the United States. You know, Mexico was conquered and they tried to claim their rights to the land. Actually, they were Mexicans who originally came from Spain or whatever, but they were, many of them were not natives, but they were the enemy anyhow. So usually, I mean, it's Israel established certain rules, which says that when you argue against the claim of a state, of the state, on land issues, the burden is on you. Now, as I said, it's almost ending the discourse. It's a mechanism that legitimating it. Now, what can you do? You can struggle about it. You can show it. You can show that it's like saying that you don't have a right. But in other countries, they start to understand that this is not justice. This is ridiculous. So what can we do? You have to struggle. About activism and academia. So I think that there are several models of academics. There is a model that the scientist does not talk to the viruses, okay? You don't befriend with the viruses and so on, if you want to do research. I don't believe in it. I mean, for myself, I think that we are a privileged group, and my view as the social role of academics, of myself, I don't say it's the only model, is that I am a very in a privileged position. I can do what I want. I can research what I want. I can, I have tenure, and I can produce knowledge that is autonomous, unlike what happens with people that work for the state or for the market. So we have a privileged position of producing knowledge. Now, I think that people that say that they are objective are often not. They just think, at best, they think they are objective, but they come with their preconditions. Now, what I do, and of course, in my field, if you work and give counseling to rich people or rich companies, that's fine. And if you do volunteer work for Bedouins, then you are not objective, you know. You know, I do it as a, on a volunteer basis. So my position is the following. I see academic knowledge as a group endeavor and not as a private endeavor. Now, what we do in this book, for example, we knew there is another group of scholars that is working with the state. We write about it in the book, you know, the politics of academia and so on. And it's very similar to things that happened in Australia in the Mabu case, which is a very important case about Aboriginal land rights. So when we wrote the book, I knew that every sentence and every footnote will be checked. And I made sure that on every footnote, not only I checked, but independently two research assistants checked what I was writing. Because I knew that it will be under much more scrutiny than regular work. And indeed, since the book was published, and before that we published articles, there was a lot of criticism. So far, I think, I must say, I'm very happy that they did not find anything that we lied or was incorrect, but this is the way I see. I mean, I see knowledge, academic knowledge, as a working out of discourse and debates, and you refute something and you continue. And I put my prejudice up front, or my position up front. I also do that when I teach. I say, this is what I'll do, this is where I come, and you as student have to be critical specifically about this position where I do it. That's the best I think you can do.
Sandy, thank you so much. I'll exercise self-control and avoid asking all those questions that I have for you. Maybe we'll keep it for a more personal session. Unfortunately, I can't invite you now to have tea together. I want to thank you so much for this fascinating talk. Thank you also for the attendees. I'm sorry we cannot see you and we cannot hang around for the small talk. Maybe that's the most crucial element missing from those virtual forums, that we don't have now the chance to mingle together and to ask questions. I am allowing myself to speak in Sandy's name. If you want to ask more, other than reading your work, maybe you can reach out to him immediately, directly, write to him, and I'm sure he'll be happy to continue the conversation. Please note that our Israel Studies seminar is now going bi-weekly, and next week we're dedicating that same spot for a different seminar series, reconsidering early Jewish nationalism, where Yair Wallach from SOAS will be the speaker. You have the details for it on all the relevant websites. Thank you so much for attending. Thank you, Sandy, for making yourself available in these hard times, and good luck with your work.
Thank you very much.